On RN, Joe Gelonesi with you for the Philosopher's Zone. Great to have your company. Today, a doctor celebrates.
I chose to interpret the old show in terms of positivism and a kind of hard science fiction mentality that cropped up every so often. The new show, though, the 2005 to the present show, I interpret in terms of romanticism and existentialism.
The Enlightenment hero who became an outsider. Doctor Who has been buzzing around the universe for 50 years in real time and at least a millennium in space-time, if you could measure it that way. In fact, just this week, the 50th anniversary episode made it to our screens, and with it, a long tale of ideas, from identity to the nature of time, personal ethics to radical evil, the uncanny to quantum entanglement. Well, it was only a matter of time before a guide to Whovian philosophy would be written.
My name is Kevin S. Decker. I work at Eastern Washington University, which is in Spokane. And my job there is Associate Professor of Philosophy, and this year I'm also serving as Associate Dean of my college, which is a lot of fun.
Kevin Decker, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. The 50th anniversary of Doctor Who, when did he first grab your attention?
Well, I guess about in 1983 when I was celebrating the 20th anniversary, and that was when I was first into the show as an American, and wondering how long it would last. And obviously with the show having been canceled and come back once and then come back again, seemingly for good, or at least for now, we're finally there. I don't know. You know, it's there were so many wilderness years for Doctor Who that it was hard to think at any given point that it would get to 50.
Mm. So you've taken a look at it through your philosopher's lens. Which strands do you think stand out that need to be looked at, that need to be discussed in Doctor Who?
Well, I think that I try to be very pluralist about interpreting the show, because one of the things that's interesting about it as a science fiction or a science fantasy pop culture artifact is that it wasn't created by one person. It's not George Lucas's Star Wars, or it's not Gene Roddenberry's Star Trek. It doesn't bear the imprint of kind of an initial set of intentions of one author, although I realize that whole concept is problematic as well. So I chose to interpret the old show in terms of positivism and a kind of hard science fiction mentality that cropped up every so often. The new show, though, the 2005 to the present show, I interpret in terms of romanticism and existentialism.
So let's talk about that change from the old series, if we could call it that, to 1989, and then the new series from 2005. Just explain to me the change from a logical positivist position to one of romanticism, existentialism, and phenomenology as well.
Right. I think that the positivism is most present if one looks at the black and white years of the show, which was 63 to 69, William Hartnell and Patrick Troughton, the first two doctors. There, the focus is either on the doctor's superior knowledge, and that knowledge is always cashed out in terms of a relatively limited view of physical science, although obviously much superior to what we have or had at the time, or that a kind of version of soft scientism, where the notion is, like with the second doctor, that if there's a solution to be found, it's to be found in this higher science, as it were. The TARDIS itself, the main artifact, the main philosophy of science object there, is interpreted wholly as being a machine, and it's only when we get later that the doctor begins to speak of it metaphorically and then literally as being alive, which is, you know, quite different, I think. It's not an explicitly positivistic focus. It sounds more organic, more romantic.
Mm. So in those early days, they were trying to cleave a bit more closely to the idea that science can solve all, that all you need is to be able to reason your way to, I guess, success. Whereas in the later series, it becomes more about, I guess, lived experience. Can you talk to me about that?
Yeah, lived experience, definitely. There's definitely a kind of individualistic strand in the show that has to do with the doctor valuing his companions for who they are and for wanting to be a kind of mentor person to them and take them, you know, into situations where, you know, it's very much a situation of wonder. And of course, the new special effects have really done a lot to make that possible. In the old show, you would see a green screen overlay with yellow highlights on the edge that made it very obvious what you're looking at least today. But that sense of wonder, and also the notion that relationships are more often than not in the new show the problem solvers. You know, that's what, you know, emotions are important, relationships are important, people will sacrifice for relationships. And that just doesn't fit into the kind of positivism that shows up in hard sci-fi, even in the version in Doctor Who, which is mitigated because, of course, I think it's always been a science fantasy show. It's never paid all that much attention to scientific laws, so, let's say, or technology.
It's pretty pretty funky with the truth when it comes to science in the early
series.
Yet, as you say, it does stay close to the Enlightenment values, nevertheless.
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the things that that is very different from the old BBC show, from the new one since 2005, is the extent to which the Doctor meets godlike characters rather than is interpreted as one. And I think in the old show, you've got a very kind of static good evil metaphysics, and that is often represented by figures like in the 1980s, the Black Guardian and the White Guardian, who are also part of the Tom Baker Key to Time story that's so famous, a whole season for that one. In the newer show, the Doctor is even more clearly a force of becoming, because all of the forces of being and nothingness, the absolutes, the Time Lords and the anti-Time Lords, although I don't know what those people would be, they're gone. The absolutes are gone. And so the Doctor's process of becoming is predicated on all the changes that you just mentioned, regeneration, never being at home, having that Heideggerian sense of homelessness.
And this is the worldhood that Heidegger talks about, the worldhood that he, well, doesn't really inhabit in any kind of substantial way.
No, he doesn't do that, and so that makes him, from a slightly older, maybe Hegelian perspective, a tragic figure. But to a certain extent, it links the new show with the old show very nicely, because the Doctor has had to create his home, and that's not something that Heidegger, I think, is interested in. I think people like Sartre and Beauvoir are interested by the individual who recognizes that they're alienated and recognizes that they have to create a home for themselves. And so the Doctor is essentially creative. He's eccentric.
This is the idea of the existential leap, isn't it? He's being an existentialist to some degree.
I think so. I think that, you know, when you compare his reasons for leaving his culture originally, which apparently are going to be focused on closely in this 50th anniversary episode, the reasons for leaving are essentially the existentialist reason for kind of disengaging from culture. That would be the early Sartre rather than the communist Sartre. But I think so. I think that there's something of the existentialist about the Doctor. Also, something of the romantic in the new focus on relationships, which, as we know, existentialists have always had problems with. Just look at Sartre and Beauvoir's personal relationship.
This change from a positivist older style in the first set of series to the more romantic, more modern, more contemporary forms of philosophical understanding in the second series, do you think that mirrors also a general change in our own outlook, people's outlook, humanity's outlook on itself in that time, in that period?
I think that that's an excellent question. And one of the things that I'm interested in exploring with that is the extent to which we're starting to identify the universe as being more anthropomorphic, in the sense that as we and our technology get closer and closer and we establish greater forms of control through technology, we kind of start to see the universe more as mirroring ourselves and not as being something as fundamentally different. As the technology becomes transparent, which I think it really is, especially in the new Doctor Who, he never says anything scientifically correct in the new show, and it's usually more about the hugging, as we all know.
very good. You cover a whole range of things. One of the other areas I wanted to talk to you about, and this is another big one really, is the notion of morality, the philosophy of morality, ethics. How does the doctor fit in with the idea of how to do the right thing?
You know, that's the way I like it. It's very, very complex. Unlike if you watch a few episodes of one of the Star Trek series, let's say the Captain Kirk one or the Next Generation, you immediately see a kind of moralism worn on the sleeve of the characters. And it has always struck me how little Doctor Who is like that. In the early parts of the show, the Doctor lectures people, you know, when they do things wrong and slaps them on the wrist. But the Doctor is an anti-hero. And I think one of the things that the show points to quite usefully is the inherent ambiguity of moral situations and the need for moral judgment and the inability to reduce things to algorithms, or when they are reduced to algorithms, the errors, you know, and the personal cost that comes to. So in some ways, the show complexifies, creates more shadows with reference to morality. But I think that's good, because I think that some of the great ethicists that I know, for example, Simon Blackburn, who I know is on your show, I think give us more to think about rather than solving every problem. Just one quick example of this. With reference to consequentialism, you know, there is a implicit empiricist metaphysics that has to do with the regularity of cause and effect, right? Because the consequentialist can be held responsible for certain consequences of their actions, but it presumes that they could have potentially predicted those, or that causes are connected to further consequences. Now, in time travel, that's all put at risk. And in fact, I could have just omitted the ethics chapter and said, you know, as many literary critics of sci-fi have pointed out, if you're able to go back and change things and absolve people of their responsibility by just simply changing history, then morality just goes right out the window. And interestingly, Doctor Who doesn't take that position. And again, I think that it fills that explanatory gap with some kind of romanticist personality building, character building.
Mm. Because if he could, I suppose he could fulfill the kind of utilitarian maximum happiness for a maximum number of people.
Right. No, that's exactly right. And he's tried to do things like that. And again, because of the plural nature of the creation of the show with many different script writers, and here I'm particularly thinking about the show before we had people like Stephen Moffat being showrunner and coordinating many things. You know, it turns out different ways for the Doctor. And so he has to find certain core values, which I think especially in the new show center on relationships and obligations and feelings and autonomy, trying to inspire people's autonomy, trying to regain his own, usually from his own his worst side, you know, his darker side. Those things are what he clings to, I think, in lieu of, let's say, a code of honor like, say, Starfleet, you know, the Star Trek characters might have.
Mm. Although the notion of evil as a black and white concept does make its mark, there is a kind of Manichaean, a dark and light universe, isn't there?
That's definitely true. It's interesting because here is a commonality between Doctor Who and Star Wars, is that the 1970s and 80s Star Wars films had that much more black and white view, whereas the new prequels, for all their flaws, do show a more ambiguous view, and to me a richer view of ethics and what a hero and what a villain is. And it's the same thing with Doctor Who. The older show was very important to the showrunners at that time to position the Doctor as being a force of good, and it would be strenuously objected to if he was seen to be a manipulator or to be using his companions as pawns. Eventually in the 1980s, it did veer in that direction, and it was very troubling, I think, for a lot of fans, including myself, but also very interesting.
You shall be like us. Kevin S. Decker on the philosophy of Doctor Who.
You agents of Abel! Ah!
I don't know what that is or even what he says.
What a 900-year-old estranged Time Lord can tell us about some eternal questions. Today on the Philosopher's Zone.
You will move ahead of us and follow my directions.
You've also taken the opportunity to consider the notion of political philosophy, particularly in the sense that it sort of comes second rate to questions in the history of philosophy, to questions of metaphysics and knowledge and mind and other big ticket philosophical items. And yet political philosophy is, as you say, extraordinarily important and does play itself out in Doctor Who.
Right. No, it does. This was in many ways the hardest chapter to write, and I knew because of my own passion for social and political theory that I really wanted to do something with it. I guess because the Doctor doesn't have a prime directive. In the early version of the show, he oftentimes is cited as saying, you know, I have to make sure that time is protected, but he changes things all the time. In the later version of the show, his interventions politically, what empires he topples, which back in the 80s, again, he used to just do for fun, apparently, when he was the Scotsman, Sylvester McCoy. Now, it's not so clear that there's a method to the madness. And that suggested to me talking about political theories that do not depend, as you say, on some sort of first philosophy or even on ethics, detaching them and seeing how that was played out in certain episodes of the show. That was tough, but very interesting to write.
Very tough, I think. What examples do you cite to follow that through, particularly with the idea of the ideal versus the empirical when it comes to trying to sort out your political approach in philosophy?
Right. Well, let me just briefly gesture to two episodes, one from the old and one from the new show. I think 1985 or 86, Colin Baker did, as the Sixth Doctor, did a very controversial episode called Vengeance on Varos. And this was one that featured video nasties and televised torture. I think one of the worst things that happened is somebody actually falling into an acid bath. But the political ramifications of it are that you have a quasi-totalitarian state in which voting is still important. In other words, it's a totalitarian state that is still clearly run by democratic voting, because the individuals who vote either punish or reward the governor who makes the policy. And when that person gets too much punishment, they're voted out by being killed, obviously. I thought that was interesting because it illustrates that big kind of glaring flaw with normative political theory, that you can have perfectly stable states that have certain virtues, like hard work in this one, that are awful, that are absolutely awful, right? That are devil's side, as it were, of it's hell on earth, and it's a stable political environment rather than being heaven on earth. The other episode that also has to do with democratic voting is from Matt Smith. It's called The Beast Below. It's a great short political meditation on democracy, and again on another Heideggerian theme of forgetting. Individuals literally vote to see the truth and object to it, or to see the truth and then forget it. And everybody votes to forget it because the truth of what makes this future society possible is too horrible for people to live with.
It's fascinating. You do get a sense. But do you think that there's a kind of a Marxist or Marxian undertow in some of the episodes?
When I first got into Doctor Who in the early 80s, American public television, it was Channel 9 where I grew up, would show Tom Baker episodes, The Fourth Doctor, in reruns. And for a while there, I thought, every other episode is about him encountering druids, and every other episode is him overthrowing an unjust economic regime. And so, from a very early age, I was spotting Marxist pastiche in Doctor Who, you might say. I think that was those economic themes were very prevalent in the 70s. I think they got undermined by a certain grim playfulness in the 80s that I would attribute to the work of people like Douglas Adams. A little bit more anarchic. The end result is that we end up today with not a Marxist doctor, but more of an anarchist doctor who I find I often disagree with some of the things that he opposes. And although everything works out in the end, of course, it's not clear to me why he takes the principled position that he does. But that's okay. I find that very entertaining. That's part of the drama.
Can you give me an example where you have taken the opposite point of view?
In his very last episode, David Tennant is put into a position where he has a companion's revolver, And he has a choice of settling a very difficult situation by shooting one or the other of two parties. And he keeps swiveling between them, almost like a reversed Sergio Leone gun shoot-off, trying to decide who to shoot. And ultimately, of course, he's not the violent doctor, and so he doesn't shoot anybody. He drops the gun. In fact, in that circumstance, he had the potential to save an enormous number of lives by exterminating somebody, to use the Daleks' word, that either of two parties who were incredibly criminally guilty. And I think he had the authority at that time to do so. And so it sounds a little bit callous, but I kind of feel like he lost the opportunity at that point to save the day and, you know, took a different route. And of course, since it's fiction, you know, he was right in the end, but I did disagree with that decision.
The other big one is personal identity. I mean, someone who regenerates so often just throws up a bunch of questions about what it is to be who you are.
Right.
Do you think we get anywhere with Doctor Who in nailing that question of personal identity?
I think that we are often focused on the notion of Locke's metaphor, or the one that is often used to describe Locke's view, John Locke here, of a rope with many different strands that connect through the rope, but some of them begin at the beginning but don't extend all the way to the end, and some of them don't begin at the beginning and extend all the way to the end. And it's because of certain continuities that this individual has something about them that makes them one distinctive person. When I teach personal identity theories in Doctor Who, I do teach a pop culture and philosophy class. I get some of the most remarkable suggestions from students who feel like people like Derek Parfit and David Hume haven't thought deeply enough about this. They say, for example, what if the Doctor really is 11 different persons, all of whom have been conditioned in some way, shape, or form to think that they're continuous with it? You know, I mean, they really turn the entire premise upside down, and they say, could this be the case? And so they really start to think about what constitutes identity and what doesn't. It's very interesting.
It's fascinating. There are so many other areas, but perhaps the last one I'll touch on with you, and it's the biggest of them all, is time and how time is dealt within the series, in the program.
Right.
It seems very straightforward. You can just get into this machine which will take you backwards or forwards, but it's not really like that, is it?
No, it's not like that at all. It's much more fragmented than that. You know, the premise of, again, say, Star Trek, is that one of the drivers of the show is that the characters can get to where they need to go and then, you know, go back home after that. Throughout most of the show, the Doctor could not control the TARDIS whatsoever. So you get a kind of fragmented sense of wandering rather than some sort of quest that he's on. If he had a quest, he probably couldn't get to where he needed to be in the quest anyway. In the last chapter, I, you know, do consider like Newtonian philosophical views that bear on that, and then come down through Einstein to just a smattering of views from quantum physics. I'm writing these additional chapters just for presentation, and one of the ones that is about romanticism a little bit more explicitly explores a new view of time from the most recent series of Doctor Who, is that the past is being changed constantly. And because cause and effect is so tightly wound, those changes are made instantaneously and no one even realizes them, which is, of course, the opposite view of the show that it started off with, that history cannot be changed whatsoever.
Kevin S. Decker of Eastern Washington University on the philosophical wanderings of the Good Doctor. He's also written about Star Wars, Star Trek, and The Terminator. And you might have caught Doctor Who celebrations in other corners of the ABC universe, including a 24-hour pop-up digital station airing all this week. If you haven't, just check our front page for details. This week's Philosopher's Zone has been brought to you by Anne-Marie de Bettencourt, Diane Dean, and me, Joe Gelonesi. We'll be back next week. Hope to see you then.